The headlines, Iraq's new Prime Minister Mohammad al-Sudani arrives in Tehran for important talks with Iranian officials. Syria denounces a Human Rights Council's recent anti-Iran resolution, saying the West exploits international mechanisms for its own political goals. Plus, the three more Palestinian fatalities are added to the list of Israeli crimes in the occupied West Bank. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammad al-Sudani is in Iran for an official visit aimed at boosting bilateral relations. Al-Sudani received a formal welcome from Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi at Saadabad Complex. The two top officials are to hold a meeting to discuss Tehran-Baghdad ties. This is al-Sudani's first official travel to a non-Arab country since he became prime minister in late October. He is leading a team of high-ranking political and economic delegates during his one-day trip. Syria's foreign minister has slammed the UN's recent anti-Iran human rights resolution, saying the West is using international bodies as a tool to reach its own political goals. In a phone call with his Iranian counterpart Faraz al-Mikdad, described the resolution as arbitrary and unacceptable. The Syrian foreign minister said the move is part of the ongoing Western measures against independent states in order to implement destructive agendas. He added that it represents a violation of the sovereignty of those states and their right to follow policies that suit the history and traditions of their people. Iran has strongly condemned the resolution by the UN Human Rights Council, which called for a probe into the country's riots that started in September. We talked to author and commentator John Stepling for his take on the recent anti-Iran resolution by the UN Human Rights Council and Tehran's reaction to it.
There's no reason at all for Iran to participate on any level with this, because it only serves to at least partly legitimize the process, and it's an illegitimate project. Iran has nothing to gain. I think they should sever all ties with the United States, I mean diplomatic ties, because I don't see the good that can come out of it at this point. The U.S. has sanctioned Iran. These are criminal sanctions. The United States sanctions almost everybody, but they have illegally sanctioned Iran. Iran agreed to the JCPOA, bent over backwards to meet all its requirements, and the United States tore it up anyway. The U.S. is very big on tearing up treaties and international agreements. Iran has done none of that, and yet they are constantly the object of this rhetorical abuse from the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, European media. It's unbelievably biased, and it's very hard, I think, for the Western public to get an accurate picture of the situation vis-a-vis Iran, because much as it is impossible for the Western public to get a picture of Russia, because the reporting is so extraordinarily biased and one-sided.
Israeli violence takes the lives of three more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank in a matter of 24 hours. Regime troopers fatally shot two young men near the city of Ramallah on Tuesday. Earlier, Israeli forces shot another Palestinian in the head after raiding the town of Beit Amr in Al-Khalil. The Palestinian Red Crescent says nearly two dozen others were also injured in the raid, nine of them with live rounds. Israel has been carrying out deadly attacks on Palestinian towns and cities in the occupied West Bank almost on a daily basis. The regime forces have killed more than 200 Palestinians in the area, as well as in Gaza, so far this year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Muna Kendall, tells us more about the deadly Israeli attacks. Let's take a listen.
The two Palestinians who were shot dead this morning in Kfar Ayn village near Ramallah were our brothers, 22-year-old Jawad Arrimawi and 21-year-old Zafer Arrimawi from the town of Beit Rima. Israeli forces raided Kfar Ayn and confrontations took place between the Palestinians and Israeli troops, ended with killing those two Palestinian brothers. Earlier, as you have mentioned, Israeli forces stormed Beit Umar village in Al Khalil, also known as Hebron, and killed 44-year-old Mufid Khalil and at least 22 others. Nine of them were shot with live rounds. Following the incident of the killing of this Palestinian in Beit Umar, Israeli troops also raided a clinic in the village to arrest the wounded people, as well as to arrest the Palestinian doctor who treated them. And here in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, a general strike was declared following the announcement of the killing of the two brothers.
An international conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to highlight the Israeli blockade and its dire consequences on Palestinians. The Israeli regime has kept to the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007, Ashraf Shannon reports.
Hamas's Council on International Relations has held an international conference on the impact of the Israeli blockade. The event aims to shed light on the crippling Israeli blockade on more than 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. The event was attended by figures representing the Gaza Government Committee and civil society organizations. They discussed ways to tackle the repercussions of the blockade. Living conditions and the standard of living in the Gaza Strip have been rapidly deteriorating under the Israeli blockade. The Hamas movement says Western countries, mainly the United States, are supporting the Israeli blockade.
The Israeli siege, unfortunately supported by the international community, mainly the Americans, have converted Gaza into the biggest open-air prison on earth. We can see the catastrophic impacts of this siege in every corner here in the Gaza Strip, which can develop up to a crime against humanity or an ethnic cleansing.
Speakers via video conference included Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Palestine, as well as Richard Falk, the chairman of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Statistics show that most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive because of the blockade.
More than 2 million Palestinians, most of them children, women, elders, and patients, are suffering from this catastrophic condition due to the continuous blockade for more than 15 years. The international community's silence leads to continue such offensive on Palestinians.
Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed under the blockade. At the conference, attendees called for the immediate lifting of the inhumane siege.
This is a call to the world to stop its a silence over what's been going on the Gaza Strip, and to urge all governments of the world in Europe and the United States and other parties around the world to intervene actively to end this illegal and punishing siege on the Gaza Strip population.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Gaza Strip is already devastated by the Israeli blockade and is edging closer to breaking point. The prolonged blockade has undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Experts say the inhumane Israeli practices have deprived Palestinians of their rights. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Ukrainian president has warned his countrymen to prepare for new Russian attacks on infrastructure, saying the raids will not stop until Moscow runs out of missiles. Volodymyr Zelensky says he expects the attacks this week to be as bad as last week. He was referring to recent Russian missile strikes targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Last week's barrage was the worst yet, leaving millions of people without electricity and water supplies. NATO, which has been a key ally of Ukraine in the war, has also predicted more attacks on Ukraine's power grid and infrastructure.
President Putin is now trying to use a weapon, use the winter as a weapon of war against Ukraine. And this is horrific, and we need to be prepared for more attacks. That's the reason why NATO allies have stepped up their support to Ukraine.
Stoltenberg was speaking ahead of a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Bucharest on Tuesday and Wednesday. The NATO chief said that supplying Ukraine with air defense systems is likely to be high on the agenda. He added that ministers would also discuss providing spare parts, training, and ammunition to Kiev. Ukrainian authorities say the Russian missile attacks are aimed at harming civilians and amount to a war crime. Moscow has acknowledged the attack, saying it seeks to reduce Ukraine's ability to fight and push it to negotiate. It denies targeting civilians. We're joined by our correspondent, Johnny Miller, live from Donetsk. Johnny, give us an update first on the situation in Donetsk. We do understand that there was an explosion close by where you are stationed. Tell us more about the situation there.
Well, yes, here in Donetsk, life continues here as usual. There is some difficulties with water. There's no water in most apartments. Electricity is okay, and Ukrainian shelling continues. A man was killed yesterday while filling up his gas. Shrapnel hit him in the head, and he was killed on the spot. Day before that, three people were killed in Makiivka. The center of Donetsk was shelled, like it was last night. So it's important to recognize as well, while Russian strikes are causing huge damage to civilian infrastructure, and particularly energy infrastructure in the west of Ukraine, Kiev, etc., Ukraine is also trying to hit civil infrastructure here in Donbass. They don't have quite the same military capability and so aren't having the same kind of success, but both sides are trying to destroy the civil infrastructure and energy infrastructure of each other.
So, Johnny, tell us about the attacks on Ukraine and how the infrastructure is being targeted. Of course, Russia has denied that it is targeting civilians. Tell us more about that.
Well, yes, these huge barrages by Russia, it's been going on for about a month now. Many of us were confused about why Russia didn't start hitting the energy infrastructure way back in February, but now they are hitting it hard. I have been told that Russia has moved some new military hardware into the Black Sea in preparation for more of these attacks, and life for normal Ukrainian citizens is getting desperate in many places. It depends where you are in Ukraine. Many places left without electricity or only electricity for a couple of hours a day, difficulties finding water, and there is a real danger if heating goes in these cities. It'd be very difficult to see how people can continue living there, frankly. And of course, if it hits hospitals and places like that, it could cause significant loss of life. Russia very much trying to make it not only difficult for Ukraine to maneuver on the battlefield, but also for them to be able to look after the basic needs of their people, and so an attempt to try and bring Ukraine very much to its knees.
So, Johnny, apparently Russia is trying to bring Ukraine to the point where they would now start negotiating a peace process. How likely do you see that happening?
Well, it depends on NATO very much. NATO has huge influence, you could even say control over Ukrainian policy. They fund it, they fund them, they arm them. Ukraine was to pull out that funding or arms, Ukraine would be forced to negotiate. It would collapse economically as well. So it really depends on what Ukraine's decisions are. Ukraine has said recently, it does seem sometimes that Ukraine is making up, NATO is making up its policy each week or each day on Ukraine. It's difficult to see their long-term strategy or whether they even have one, frankly. But NATO has said that they want to continue to support Ukraine to see if they can have more success on the battlefield. Of course, in the last couple of months, Ukraine has had success on the battlefield in the Kharkov region and taking Kherson. So NATO, I think, hoping that Ukraine can take maybe another major settlement or more ground for to strengthen their position at the negotiating table. But at the moment, that's a dangerous game, because at the moment around Donetsk and north of here in Artemovsk or Barmut, it's the Russians that are going forward. That city now has been described even in NATO-friendly media as being hell on earth, with hundreds of killed and wounded Ukrainians. So at the moment, at least around Donetsk, it seems to be the Russians that are moving forward. So NATO are playing a dangerous game. But Russia, as you say, trying their best to bring Ukraine to its knees and to force them to the negotiating table.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Johnny Miller, joining us live from Donetsk. Moving on, in Austria, railway workers have staged a day-long strike over pay, bringing trains to standstill and creating travel chaos across the country. The strike has impacted around 8,000 connections and some 1 million passengers. The 24-hour walkout followed the failure of a fifth round of negotiations between the government and the union. The main rail workers' union is calling for a $417 monthly pay rise for some 50,000 employees. The union has warned about more industrial actions. Authorities say services would be more or less back to normal by the following day. Austria is an important hub for rail travel in Europe, connecting 8 countries, including Italy, Germany, Switzerland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. Moving now to China, where calm is restored after weekend protests against restrictive COVID policies. The capital, Beijing, and Shanghai, people are back to the daily routine of mass testing for coronavirus, and that is part of China's zero COVID strategy to contain the virus that has infected hundreds of people in the cities over the past days. Amid lockdowns imposed under the policy, some Chinese cities have witnessed street protests against the restrictions. The rallies were reportedly fueled by a fire at a building in the Xinjiang region. It is said that a lockdown in the area impeded rescue efforts and led to the deaths of some residents. The government, however, has rejected any link between the protests and the incident. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we discussed the election of Abul Hassan Bani Sadr as the first Iranian president and also talked about the events leading to his dismissal. This time, we are going to touch upon the period between Bani Sadr's escape from the country and the election of martyr Muhammad Ali Rajai as the second president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Stay tuned, please. Thank you. The period of mid-June till mid-August 1981 was the time when Abolhassan Bani Sadr was deposed of presidency and Muhammad Ali Rajai was elected as the second president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Bani Sadr was dismissed due to his mismanagement as the president, particularly in the field of administration of the war as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Many important events occurred during this period. The martyrdom of Dr. Mustafa Chamran was one of these events. He was one of the brave commanders of the war and had devoted his life to the cause of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution since he was in the U.S. as a student or a guerrilla combatant in Lebanon. The news of his martyrdom was very sad for the Iranian people. Imam Khomeini's wife was dumbfounded at hearing the news. Ms. Khadija Saghafi had said on Chamran, "Chamran was a mythical man. What we hear about him may be unbelievable for the next generations." A few days after Chamran's martyrdom, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei was injured in a terrorist act while speaking at Abu Zar Mosque in the south of Tehran. He was Imam Khomeini's representative at the Supreme Defense Council, a member of the Islamic Assembly Council or Parliament, and the leader of Friday Congregational Prayer in Tehran. He was the person who had mentioned some of the points of political incompetency of Bani Sadr at the Parliament. Just one day after this act of terror, some 72 officials were martyred in a bomb blast at the place of the Islamic Republic Party. The judiciary chief of the time, Ayatollah Muhammad Hosseini Beheshti, was the highest official who lost his life during the explosion. The blast was carried out by the MKO terrorist grouplet, which killed more than 17,000 people, mostly innocent men, women, and children. The imposed war, successive martyrdom of the companions of Imam Khomeini, economic shortages and criminal acts of terrorist outfits such as the MKO could not impact Imam Khomeini's iron willpower and firm belief in God. On the contrary, he kept calling on people to put their trust in God and resist against the enemies of Islam and Iran. In such circumstances, some people were seeking to attribute mythical acts and extraordinary measures to the imam, but the imam's wife blocked the way of such superstitions and the likely consequences. During a meeting with some of the ladies from various walks of life, one of the attendees asked for some miracles from Imam Khomeini. The imam's wife answered, "One of the miracles of the imam is that I have never heard a lie from him during living with him. Another miracle of him is that he never dissipates a single rial, Iranian currency. His third miracle is that he seriously avoids extravagance. The last miracle is that, unlike many mystics who shun people, the imam believes in people. He expects miracle from people and believes that people can work a miracle." Then she read out part of the imam's words, where he had said, "It is a miracle that you, sisters and brothers together, with one sound and clenched fist, have stood against satanic powers. This is the miracle of Islam, which has been manifested in you. This is a miracle that the martyrdom of a dear one stirs up a wave in the world. This is a miracle that ladies do not fear against tanks, cannons, and machine guns." Dear listeners, it is very interesting to know how martyr Ayatollah Beheshti was careful of every minute point within the domain of his responsibility. For instance, while Bani Sadr had gone into hiding after dismissal, his wife was arrested on the street. She was provoking people through chanting slogans in favor of her husband. Ayatollah Beheshti, being informed of the event, phoned the prosecutor general and told him with discontent, "Although we have differences with Bani Sadr, his allegations have not been proved in any just court yet, and even if they are proved, no one is allowed to insult or violate the rights of his wife. Thus, Bani Sadr's wife should be freed in less than 24 hours. If this does not happen, I will do the job personally as the judiciary chief." Dear listeners, Martyr Beheshti said these words while Bani Sadr had left no stone unturned in calumniating him and insulting him here and there. Imam Khomeini, as soon as hearing what Martyr Beheshti's statements read, said, "Mr. Beheshti is right. If that lady has been arrested for this purpose and she has no other allegation, she should be freed right now. Moreover, they should offer an apology to her too." Ahmad Agha was happy with the political piety of Ayatollah Beheshti and he described it to her mother. Lady Saghafi told him on Martyr Beheshti, "This man should be appreciated. Thank him on my behalf." The Imam's wife went to Bani Sadr's wife several times and, in spite of being upset with Bani Sadr, never spoke behind her in any party.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Meeting to have convened with no legal basis, based on inaccurate conclusions and findings. It was also based on an initiative put forward by Germany and Iceland. The UN Rights Council convened, then described the Iran riots as a government crackdown on deadly protests, and now it has voted to appoint a probe into what they have termed Iran's deadly crackdown on protests. Well, Iran has rejected the whole thing outright and has said that it will not cooperate with the agency. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the UN body lacks the grounds for conducting the so-called investigation and how it has opened itself to lose even more legitimacy on the international stage. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Firsal Najim, a manager at the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joins us from Toronto. Also joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Elijah Magnier, I'll first start with you. I'm holding in my hands What is the criteria for communication to be accepted for examination at the UNHRC? And out of the seven statements that they have here for what needs to be qualified in order to actually have a criteria to open up a UN rights probe, six out of the seven of that does not meet the criteria that was put forward by Germany and Iceland. For example, number one, it is not manifestly politically motivated and its object is consistent with the Charter of the UN. It gives a factual description, that's number two, of the alleged violations, including the rights which are alleged to be violated. So there's seven of them. Six of them don't meet that criteria. So that puts the legality of the motion put forward by Germany and Iceland into doubt.
Thank you for having me. It doesn't matter, really. It's not important what the points contain, because it is a decision of the West to put pressure on Iran and find different excuses to do so. Now, we've seen how the pressure on Iran and the nuclear deal didn't work. The riots didn't work to change the regime in Iran. And now they try to put all the different Western institutions in motion to try to put more pressure on Iran from different angle to push Iran to the negotiation table or to keep Iran away from supporting Russia in Ukraine and make sure that Iran is not interfering in the plan of the West to cripple Russia, and also to say to Iran, well, we need to conclude the deal, not to the Iranian terms, but to the Western terms. Therefore, we can see different aspects of the West manifested through the United Nations, through the IAEA, through all kind of tools that the West is always using and falling back to, only to weaken the position of Iran and to bring Iran back to the line with the United States and its allies, or at least to bring it weak to the negotiation table.
But first, on the team, when you take a look at the way that the events unfolded from the perspective of the West in particular, you're looking at how they went out, they did a smear campaign on Iran. They did not really divulge the public opinion and inform the public opinion or the public about what is actually happening inside of Iran. They left out so many things, but the smear campaign reached a maximum point, not only through the media, but also through different types of these so-called demonstrations that took place or protests, whether it was in Germany or Sweden or the States. And then here you are. You have a UN convening, the UNHRC convening, and then wanting to do a probe, obviously putting a resolution and slamming Iran for what it calls the government crackdown on these protests. So they went out and they pretty much found Iran guilty by building up to it.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, this body is dominated by certain powers and they have an agenda and they're pushing their agenda forward. And, you know, the good thing is that Iran is resisting and Iran is, you know, exposing this body and showing that it's not truly working for human rights. And if it really did work for human rights, then it would punish the German regime that, you know, supplied chemical weapons to Saddam and killed thousands of Iranians, and as well, how many of them have been, you know, still till this day suffering from the consequences of that illegal measure that was done by the Saddam regime at that time. So how come they didn't hold accountable the German regime for these crimes that they're doing? And how about they didn't hold the German regime accountable for supplying arms to Saudi Arabia that's killing the Yemeni people day and night and blockading the people of Yemen? So this is a very biased approach and plan, and it's going to fail hopefully, because they've always failed with Iran, with the Islamic Republic of Iran and its wise leadership. It's been very clear that they cannot win anything in this battle. Like, they've always lost and they've always tried to do something to put pressure and to cause some kind of division inside and weaknesses, and they've always continued to flee, but they continue to try new methods and different tactics and strategies. And you know, it's unfortunate they don't really work for human rights, because if they did, they could really quickly stop a lot of wars happening in different countries and can stop international law breaches, especially by the Israeli regime, for instance, that continues to breach the international law. How come they have never adopted a resolution for an unbiased, investigation to the crimes such as killing Shireen Abu Akleh or shooting a Canadian doctor, Tariq Labouni. At that time, they were actually having some kind of resolution. They were trying to adopt it, and it failed because there was bullying going on inside the United Nations, and including Canadian UN ambassador at that time. He also worked to have that not successful. He didn't want an international independent investigation done on a Canadian doctor that was shot. He thought it was biased, and that's what he said to the Zionists in Canada to try to satisfy them. So the human rights is all selective, and they're biased, and they're working for a certain agenda, and what fits their agenda, they do. And this is why they're working right now on the Iran file, and especially at the time where there's the World Cup and people are busy, they're trying to put more pressure and more plans against Iran. And Sayyid Khamenei has spoken yesterday about that in the Besiege weekly meeting. He said that we got to be careful because right now they're planning different things while people are busy watching the World Cup.
Indeed. Well, when you take a look at what's happened and how things have progressed from what first started out as peaceful protests, of which it was then robbed by these rioters, of which it led to the destruction of property and basically violence to be encouraged by different media outlets, even politicians, hasn't the landscape changed, Elijah Magnier, from one that now the UN is presenting it as a human rights issue, where Iran is looking at it through a different lens, such as the time where just days ago, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, came out and said, first accusing Israel and Western intel services of plotting to start a civil war in the Islamic Republic, where he said various security services, Israel and some Western politicians, have made plans for this. And then he said, of course, Iran is not Libya or Sudan. There's not a day that goes by that we don't see arms trying to force its way through that doesn't get confiscated or that's discovered. Or you have different terrorist groups that are operating, such as the MKO cult or Kamala or PJAC. Of course, we had that terrorist incident that happened in Isfahan, of which we had 15 people who were killed, and it was Daesh-related. So this is now a matter of people being killed in that arena, in that environment. It's not about human rights now. There's an assault that's happening on Iran. Shouldn't it be looked that way and for countries to try to prevent that from happening?
Well, yesterday we had a big protest in the street of Brussels, and the police was quite violent with the population. We saw also in other European states, in Germany, in France, how the police behaved. We've seen that in the US. All that doesn't matter really, because mainstream media is focused particularly on everything that is happening in Iran. So when we see a man throwing Molotov on civilian houses, that is not reported in Iran. However, we've seen any fake movement and any fake pictures that show something that happened in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in Yemen and reported as it is in Iran. Then we see even the Prime Minister of Canada retweeting that Iran is going to kill 15,000 protesters that are in jail. So it has reached a laughable level where the credibility of the West is not only in jeopardy, but is completely lost. But it doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, there is an agenda that they pushed against Iran since 1979, to cripple the Iranian population and to talk about the Western human rights. That is the real title of it. It's a double standard, because as the Americans say to their foreign minister who takes the job, and here I'm quoting Rex Tillerson, we use human rights against our enemy like Iran, Cuba, Russia, and China, and Korea, and we don't use it against our friend. So it is obviously a tool, and I'm not inventing anything. I'm just repeating the word of the American themselves within the same administration against the enemy of the U.S. or against those who are refusing to submit to the U.S. policy and are challenging the U.S. hegemony in the Middle East West Asia and other parts of the world, including Latin America. So we have seen this behavior, harsh sanction against Venezuela, Cuba, now Russia, Iran since 1979. All that falls into the same box and is the same playbook, is we have to cripple any regime, any state that stand against us. Now, the Americans have quite a strong influence over the Europeans, so they push the German to do their dirty laundry. They push other countries, depending on each time what is the cause, to show to the world there is a diversity of countries who are saying exactly the same thing, and it is not the U.S. behind it, which is not true because everything is manipulated by the U.S. One of the main advisor of a European prime minister told me we receive a piece of paper where it is written, this is what you need to do, and then we do it according to what the Americans want without really negotiating if that falls into our interest or not. Sure. So that is the practice here in Europe.
Well, what's happening is that the way that the population in general is suffering for El Salam Najim is due to the sanctions that have been exercised against Iran now for decades. And in particular, we're looking at how that has been ramped up with this so-called maximum pressure campaign, of which it got worse when the former U.S. president tore up that JCPOA agreement. I mean, at this point, if we were just to look at the area of pharmaceuticals and medicine, the prices have skyrocketed in this country by so many times. And if this was controlled, if this was even it's supposed to be excluded from the sanctions, but it's not. People are not able to access, or the country is not able to access, life-saving medicine in a variety of different areas that it's needed. So then it becomes a human rights issue, but the source emanates from the West that has exercised these sanctions, in particular the U.S.
Yes, unfortunately, you know, this is their unhumanitarian style. That they don't care about the humans that are suffering inside Iran. But as long as their agenda and their strategy is working, this is what counts for them, and this is what they feel they're doing right. So they want to hurt the Iranian nation so they can somehow be angry with the government, and then hopefully, you know, in the coming years or days, that those people will rise up against the government when they... you know, when there's an issue or there's a problem, and they can somehow, you know, instigate, somehow infiltrate and do what they're doing. And this is exactly what they're doing right now in Iran. They found the opportunity because there is a good amount of people in Iran that are suffering because of the unlawful sanctions against the Iranian people and the Iranian government. And this also, you know, brought their sentiments up and their energy up, and they went out and protested, and then all the social media backing, all this mainstream media backing, all these, you know, so-called human rights organizations in the West started pushing so heavily, and people started, you know, being deceived. You know, some people that are in the streets, not everybody. Obviously, there's a good portion of people in Iran that have a lot of wisdom, and they trust their leadership, and they trust the agenda of the government of Iran. But, you know, these type of developments only show you and expose the West. That they don't care about human rights, that they do not care about the actual Iranian nation. They do not care about, sovereignty. They do not care about liberty. They do not care about justice. They don't care about human rights. They care about their interests, and that is to control the region and to support the Israeli regime that is the base that supports their control of the region. As long as they have that base there, they can, they can get information. They can launch wars. They can have allies that are puppets that can help them also with giving them good information and using their land as a base to control the region. And Iran has been in the forefront to fight all this imperialist powers, control of the region, and to support the Palestinian oppressed people to liberate their land from these usurpers, from these war criminals and mercenaries.
Looking at the way that the news is covered by some of these media outlets, Elijah Magyar. One of the agencies that they mention is an activist news agency called HRANA, of which it is cited, based on the most recent report, that a few hundred protesters had been killed, and it mentioned 63 minors to have been killed. It also said that 60 members of the security forces had been killed. Now, none of these numbers can be verified, because those numbers that they are getting is not based on actual records that they have access to or based on any type of government insight into this and then verification. But what is interesting, and the reason why I'm mentioning this, is that when they talk about, for example, the number that's been detained, they fail to mention how many hundreds, in some cases, are then released after a few days, because we're dealing with protests and protesters or rioters in many other cases that get arrested. So they don't mention the ones that get released. At the same time, the number of security forces that have been killed is not something that is even given any type of elaboration on, except for it to be mentioned. They don't talk about the way that these security forces, not only how they're defending the country, but how they're being killed. So they're basing it on a very biased source. This particular source has been mentioned a number of times. Isn't that then presenting a false picture?
It is, and the mainstream media is going to be very harsh on Iran because they have learned the lesson from Syria. I've covered the war in Syria for over 10 years. Every single day we dealt with this misinformation and manipulation, the pictures, and the journalists who are supposed to be professional, they would contact anyone in the street with a mobile phone and then just take anything that this person would say as a face value and become the story of the day. So we have seen how bombs were lie down on a bed without being exploded and saying that these are chemical bombs. We've seen people how they are thrown at with water because they washing them from chemical attacks. So all these kind of manipulation that I've seen in other wars and now in Ukraine is also applied in Iran heavily. And all that has one objective, is just to demonize Iran and show how the Iranian regime is so harsh on the population, how there is a violation of human rights, and how we need to free the population of Iran. This is exactly what President Biden said, and then his national security advisor needed to apologize in secrecy to Iran via Qatar and saying, well, he didn't really mean that. So the objective, we hear it from the American, they want either to change the regime in Iran or to submit it. So by manipulating pictures and not showing how people are walking in the street and these are the criminals in Iran who are stabbing a police officer who are unarmed and they are not allowed to shoot at the protesters, but they are killed in the street because they don't have any means to defend themselves. Well, we don't see this in mainstream media because we're not supposed to feel in, and support the Iranian government. We're supposed to be against it and against anything that Iran is doing by just watching a few minutes of any video posted on social media, and then this becomes the ultimate truth. This is a media manipulation that Iran is suffering from and will suffer even more because their Iranian enemies are becoming better and better. They're improving their capability. They're using not only fake news, but fake images. They can put any picture, any voice on the person and say, well, this is the proof that this person said that or did this or did that. So we're coming into a very sophisticated media and information war that every country needs to be very well equipped to stand against it, to face it, and to fight against it.
Last question, since we've ran out of time. Iran's government spokesperson, Kanani, has said, for Farah al-Najim, that Iran has proof that Western nations were involved in these riots that have swept many parts of the country, where he said, quote, we have specific information proving the U.S. Western countries and some of the American allies to have had a role in these riots. He's going to obviously have at a later date make a presentation on that, or the intelligence ministries. I wish they have come out and said that before also and provided some evidence of that. Is that what Iran should do, is present the evidence that it has and then stop there, or should Iran do more? Less than a minute, if you can, please.
Yes, I mean, Iran has to obviously produce the evidence in front of the world, in front of the media, in front of the United Nations, and expose these regimes and expose these media outlets as well. and you know, go further to complain also at the United Nations and to punish and penalize you know, this manipulation and this defamation project against Iran. And you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, the besieged did a very good job, those volunteers inside of Iran. And this is the Basij week, as Sayyid Khamenei said, that they're very important, you know, force inside Iran that, you know, keeps Iran safeguarded and supports the Islamic Republic of Iran, and keeps also the moral codes up to date and standards based on the Islamic laws, and that the West need to respect other people's laws, and they need to understand that not everybody has to follow their laws and their morals, you know, their standards of morals. And they need, they're learning that a little bit now in Qatar, and okay, hopefully they'll start to learn more about that, the Islamic Republic of Iran's laws.
Thank you very much for that, Faraz Al-Najim. Manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatwe and the team, it's goodbye. Until the next Spotlight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have a very special guest speaker, Dr. Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of talqin al-mayyit, you know, reciting some phrases for the deceased before burying him or her in the grave. First of all, explain for us a little bit about the philosophy behind talqin al-mayyit. What is it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, talqin al-mayyit means to repeat some phrases which are mainly about the basic beliefs of a Muslim. And of course, it's not limited to the people who have passed away. We have three stages for talqin. First of all, for the people who are about to pass away, it's recommended for the people around him or her to ask him or her to repeat the phrases. And then when the dead person is going to be buried, and after burying the mayyit, it is also recommended for people to come and again to repeat those phrases. Those phrases. We have this concept from the narrations of the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salam. For example, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, do talqin for the people who are about to die by saying La ilaha illallah, meaning that ask the people who are about to die to say La ilaha illallah.
Yes.
Because if they're able to say La ilaha illallah at that time, it means that they have a good end and they will go to paradise. Of course, I will explain.
Yes.
And we have some narrations about referring to the fact that it's not only about the concept of monotheism, it is also about the concept of prophethood, yes, of the Prophet and the imamate of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt.
Now you are talking about the main concept of talqin.
Exactly.
But before that, you know, there are some customs done, one of which is, for example, telling the dead body or the deceased body, listen, understand, you know, and then unknotting the shroud or something like that.
Yeah.
Why telling a dead body, listen, for example, Isma, Ifham, listen, understand? He does not understand anything, does it?
So, first of all, for the people, as I mentioned, talqin al-mayyit has different stages.
Yes.
For the first stage, it is still the person is alive.
Yes.
And we are asking him or her to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second stage, he or she is dead. So for the first stage, it is, of course, logical because they are still alive and they can understand.
You mean during the lifetime, not at the bed, death of deathbed?
No, at deathbed.
At deathbed,
when they're
about
to die, is recommended to do talqin too, ask the people to repeat the phrases. Having said that, let me give the dear listeners an example. Imagine that you're going to have to take an exam.
Yes.
And you have already studied all the lessons, and now you're going to, this is the day for the exam, and you have too much stresses.
Yes.
Now, if there is someone, there is a teacher who talks to you and just repeats to you the main lessons, the main point in the lessons, it has an effect. It will reduce your stress.
Yes.
And it also helps you to remember the basic points in the lessons that you have already studied. Now, this is the point about the concept of talqin. We are not talking about doing talqin for a non-believer. No, it doesn't have any effect. The concept of talqin doesn't mean that, if a person has been a wicked person committing all kinds of sins, he's not the true believer, and now through talqin he will change. You're going to change his destiny or her destiny, especially after the death. No, we're not talking about that.
Okay.
We're talking about believers, true mu'mini, true Muslims. Of course, they may have committed some sins, but at the end of the day, they are good people.
Yes.
Like the person who has not studied the lessons at all, he has too much stresses. And if even a teacher talks to him,